This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we will have a debate about fossil fuels. Which is the lesser of the two evils? Should we switch to natural gas in order to get off the coal? But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your news. Bloomberg.com reports, Citigroup, Inc. plans to lend, invest, and facilitate deals worth $100 billion by 2025 to support projects that will fight climate change and protect the environment. Citigroup expects the effort to lead to deals supporting renewable power, energy efficiency, and sustainable transportation opportunities, Chief Executive Officer Michael Corbett said in a speech in New York Wednesday. The effort builds on an earlier goal to arrange $50 billion in deals that the bank set for itself in 2007 and achieved in 2013, 3 years ahead of the schedule. Citigroup's new target puts it well ahead of other financial companies, including Bank of America Corp, which said in 2012 it would support $50 billion in deals for low-carbon initiatives, and Goldman Sachs Group Incorporated, which announced a $40 billion program the same year. Slate.com reports, the Eiffel Tower now has a new set of wind turbines. Earlier this year, the New York City-based renewable energy design firm UGE installed the turbines, which are now spinning above the tower's second level, 400 feet above ground level. The wind turbines aren't big. They are designed to produce about 10,000 kilowatts of electricity each year, enough to offset the tower's electricity use in commercial areas, equivalent to the annual average use of a single U.S. home. In addition to the wind turbines, the tower's environmentally friendly retrofit includes LED lighting and a rainwater recovery system that pipes water directly to the toilets on site. Gromadsky noted that the Eiffel Tower is already 100% powered by renewable energy, which is produced off-site as a part of a citywide goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 25% by 2020 and 75% by 2050. So the new wind turbines are more of a publicly visible manifestation of that goal and a meaningful step towards achieving it. FastCompany.com and Good.com report, the city of Portland, Oregon have replaced a section of its existing water supply network with Lucid Energy pipes containing four 42-inch turbines. As water flows through the pipes, the turbines spin and power attached generators, which then feed energy back into the city's electrical grid. Portland's new energy source is scheduled to be up and running at full capacity this month. Lucid Energy's system isn't affected by nor dependent upon external conditions, unlike energy produced from solar or wind sources. Nor does the technology have adverse effects on a surrounding environmental ecosystem, as it is completely ensconced within a pipe. As the system provides clean electricity, it can also monitor both the overall condition of a city's water supply network as well as assess the drinking quality of the water flowing through it. Once fully operational, the installation is expected to generate enough electricity to power up to 150 homes per year. EcoWatch.com reports, BioBean, a new London-based company, is upcycling coffee grounds into biofuel, which can help power buildings and fuel cars while reducing waste. After collecting the grounds, the company transports it to their processing plant in North London, where machines turn these old grinds into biomass pellets and biodiesel in a patented process. This carbon-neutral fuel is then sold to businesses to power buildings and vehicles. Coffee shops usually pay to have their grounds incinerated, taken to an anaerobic digestion plants, or dumped into a landfill where it releases harmful greenhouse gases, and the company points out on their website. But with BioBean, coffee grounds go further than giving you your morning fix. And EcoWatch.com also reports that President Obama vetoed the Keystone XL pipeline bill after it was sent to his desk last Tuesday. It is the third time President Obama has used his veto power, but the fight over the pipeline isn't over yet, as the U.S. State Department's long approval process for the Keystone XL continues. And finally, the Supreme Court found Nebraska stole water from Kansas. Hear more about this at the end of our program tonight, as we play a clip from This Week in Water. And now I'd like to turn over the show to Mr. Craig Lubo.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. And my guest tonight, I have two guests, is Joe Spiess. Joe is an environmental activist with the Sierra Club, and he is the, I guess, legislative coordinator and energy chair of the Energy Committee, and John Kerman, and he is an environmental activist. He used to be active mostly with Sierra Club, but now he's primarily with 350.org. And our topic tonight, it's going to be hopefully a lively and spirited debate. I think we can all agree that the environmental community agrees that we need to move off of fossil fuels into renewables. And some disagreement is to the estimate as to how long that might take. I've heard people suggest that if we do everything we need to and we had the political will, et cetera, that we could perhaps close down the coal plants and get rid of natural gas within 5 or 10 years. And others think it's going to take, maybe I've seen people suggest more like around 30 years on the more realistic side. So in the meantime, the question is until we get off the fossil fuels, what is the lesser of the evils? Some people suggest that it would be best to avoid natural gas, and if we have to continue to operate the coal plants on coal, to continue to do that while we phase it out. On the other side, we have some environmentalists that believe that coal is by far the worst, and that in spite of the fracking, that getting rid of replacing coal with natural gas would be preferable until we get completely onto renewables. And of course, in this sense, we talk about renewables and fossil fuels as it relates to electric generation. We're also going to talk about a little bit about should we be encouraging electric plug-in cars until in those areas that are primarily dependent on natural gas and or coal until we get rid of those two uses. So, Joe, I believe you're the one that takes the position that the coal plants are the lesser of the two evils between that and natural gas. So, tell me your opinions on that.
Yeah, that's not necessarily the case. The problem with this issue of looking at coal power and natural gas, and which would be the lesser of these evils as we move to the transition to renewables, was based on the understanding that natural gas, when combusted, produced half the greenhouse gases that we get from combusting coal power and you're making electricity. And that's true. But what people weren't factoring in when they were looking at coal and natural gas several years ago, when we were assuming that natural gas would be the lesser of the evils, was the amount of methane that's released during the fracking process. And what we've come to understand is that just based on the greenhouse gas emissions, and you're looking at the fugitive methane that's released during the fracking process, it turns out that natural gas is actually, at least based on the most recent studies, there have been several studies done from this by Cornell University, MIT, Duke University, the EPA has been doing some studies too, and they all agree that the fugitive methane, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, makes natural gas at least twice as bad as burning coal power for electricity. And there are several studies that suggest that it's actually far higher than that, that burning natural gas for electricity would actually be closer to 4 to 7 times worse than coal power. So what we've been suggesting is that none of them are good, and what would make even better sense is to really expedite the study and use of energy storage, whether that's from batteries or flywheels or pumped hydro or compressed energy, or any of those energy storage options combined with wind and solar power, as the better way to get completely off of coal power and natural gas. Now, the argument is whether we can accomplish that energy storage use quickly enough. Batteries are still very expensive. There aren't a lot of compressed energy storage projects in development. There are far more than there were even just a year ago. But that's the gist of the argument that I would make.
Okay. John, let me hear your response.
Sure. First of all, just to put a little lay of the land out here, we know that we have a bunch of really old and inefficient coal-fired power plants, and that with the new emissions regulations coming through the Clean Power Plan, assuming that the EPA doesn't somehow get completely undermined by our Republican-controlled Congress, is going to make those old coal-fired power plants unaffordable to upgrade to meet the emission standards, and so they're going to have to shut down. A lot of them are going to have to shut down. So we're going to have this issue where we're going to have to be generating more electricity. Now, I absolutely agree with Joe that what we should be doing is ramping, going all in on efficiency to cut how much electricity we're using, and building out the clean energy infrastructure. So we really should not be looking at building new fossil fuel powered plants at all. That's what we should be going all in. Now, is there a broad political consensus for the policies we need to make that happen? Unfortunately not. When it comes to emissions, I would say that Joe and I aren't too far apart here. We agree that just from combustion, a state-of-the-art natural gas-fired power plant produces in the range of 50 to 60% lower carbon pollution than a state-of-the-art coal-fired power plant. The difference would be even greater if we're talking about these old, inefficient coal-fired power plants compared to a state-of-the-art natural gas-powered plant. But Joe's absolutely right that we can't only look at the carbon pollution that comes from combusting the coal at the plant. We have to look at the emissions of methane throughout the entire production and distribution system for methane, because, of course, methane is much more potent heat-trapping gas than carbon dioxide is. The figures, the IPCC, within the past couple of years, raised their estimate of the equivalency, and now they say that over a 100-year time frame, methane is 34 times as potent at trapping heat as carbon dioxide, and over the more relevant time frame of 20 years, it's 86 times more potent. So, yes, methane that escapes to the atmosphere is a huge problem for us. Now, the reading I've done still argues, though, that natural gas is preferable to coal. And here's my reasoning on that, and I'll grant you, I'm not a scientist. I'm certainly not a power plant expert. But the fact of the matter is we are going to be continuing to produce natural gas for the foreseeable future because we need it for home heating. We don't have an alternative home and other building heating right now. We don't have an immediate alternative for that. So we've got to keep producing it, which means we need to get a handle on these fugitive methane emissions. We need to tackle where these leaks are coming from, and as much as possible. We're dealing with a gas here. Gases are by their nature hard to contain. We're never going to eliminate leakage entirely, but we can do a much better job. The industries, the natural gas industry, has had no real incentive to crack down on these emissions because the EPA has been consistently underestimating them. Their most recent estimate is that 1.65% of the methane that's produced in the U.S. leaks as these fugitive methane emissions. But as Joe was saying, a range of new studies are coming up with substantially higher estimates. I haven't seen ones as high as Joe's talking about. I'm not saying they're not out there. They're just not the ones I've seen. The fact of the matter is we don't know how much methane is leaking in the entire system. Some of these studies have been criticized as having focused on the real outliers, the worst emitters, the ones that are really leaking badly. We don't know what the average is across the entire national production and distribution system for natural gas. But whatever it is, it's too damn high, and we need to be cracking down on these companies and forcing them to shut these leaks off as much as possible. Again, we're not going to eliminate them entirely. So we have to do that anyway. We're going to be producing natural gas anyway. Natural gas, the fact of the matter, has really great advantages over coal If we get a handle, and we have to get a handle on these fugitive methane emissions. First of all, it's much better for other air pollutants. Coal is far more polluting than natural gas when it comes to sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, arsenic, mercury, particulates, and on and on and on. I mean, coal is filthy dirty. The other thing with coal is that, for obvious reasons, we use the highest quality, the best coal first in this country. So what's left is worse and worse and worse. Lower in energy content, higher in pollutants. So the coal is getting worse. So that problem, the problem with pollutants from coal-fired power plants, is only going to get worse without really expensive upgrades to the scrubber systems and all that sort of thing on coal-fired power plants. The Union of Concerned Scientists, which is an organization I often turn to for guidance when it comes to scientific issues, because I'm not a scientist, does argue that despite these fugitive methane emissions, natural gas is better than coal. Again, they say we need to get a hold on the emissions. One great advantage that natural gas has over coal-fired power plants is that natural gas plants can be powered up and down very quickly. So they are great as providing the backup for the intermittency of solar and wind power. Coal-fired power plants can't be ramped up and down as quickly as natural gas power plants can. So all that rambling on basically comes down to, we don't need to be building new power plants that are combusting fossil fuels, period, in my opinion. We need to be building clean energy infrastructure. But as these old coal-fired power plants are being forced to retire, I think relying more on natural gas, the natural gas plants we already have, ramping those up more, makes more sense than building new coal-fired power plants, for sure. And we need those natural gas plants as the backup until we get the better energy storage mechanisms for clean energy that I'm talking about. And I'll take a break from talking now.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't BPU have one of their plants, aren't they changing it from coal to natural gas?
I believe they are converting. Yeah. So that's another option, is that at least in some cases, coal-fired power plants can be converted to natural gas-fired power plants without building a new power plant entirely.
All right. And we're ready for a break, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Diane Hennessy Powell, author of The ESP Enigma. Next time in New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the science behind psychic phenomena.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
Okay, we're back, and again, we are talking about the merits of using natural gas versus coal while we work on transferring from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And we have Joe Spies and John Kerman here. We were talking about before you respond, Joe, we were talking about methane versus CO2. And you said methane, the potency of it, mm-hmm. over 20 years and over 100 mm-hmm. years. But in the long run, let's say 500 years, my understanding in the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that methane will eventually dissipate faster than CO2?
Methane dissipates very quickly, actually. Okay. My understanding is that methane, once emitted to the atmosphere, only stays there for about a dozen years, whereas some of the carbon dioxide we're emitting by being on the radio, using electricity to run our transmitter and everything here, will still be here more than 1,000 years in the future. But methane's a much more potent heat-trapping gas, and we have this crunch where we need to bring emissions down to halt catastrophic global warming real soon. So that 20 years over which methane is 86 times as potent a heat-trapping gas as carbon dioxide is extremely important. There's no doubt about that. Because, yeah, there really is a too late when it comes to avoiding catastrophic climate disruption.
So in over a 20 or 30-year period, if we assume that 30 years from now we can hopefully have 80 or 90% of our energy coming from renewables, then if we only talk about 20 to 30 years and we talk about the natural gas dissipating much quicker, it seems like that would be the preferred fossil fuel to use as a bridge fuel over coal just because of that.
Well, there are other problems that need to be considered, though, as we're looking at this, and we haven't talked about those yet. There are a host of other problems associated with the fracking process, which we have to assume is going to be the production process responsible for most of the natural gas we're going to be using going forward. And those issues involve water contamination from the fracking process and now earthquakes that are resulting as a result of disposing of the fracking fluids into injection wells. These are additional problems that are serious problems in their own right, removed from the greenhouse gas issue. And we can't ignore those. Recently, it was in the fall, I think October, might have been September, but in California, 3 billion gallons, that's billion with a B, of toxic fracking waste fluids leaked from these injection wells into a vitally important aquifer in the Central Valley in California. And
Where much of the nation's produce is grown.
Yeah, and that this is another serious problem associated with fracking. And we also know that thousands of water wells have been contaminated, not necessarily with the toxic fracking chemicals that are used in the fracking process, but also from methane that's escaping. And here's the problem that we have, and here's the risk that you have with fracking. The problem is with the failure of the casings that are used when you're drilling. In the fracking process, you drill down about a mile, and then once you've reached the geologic rock strata that contains the oil or gas that the oil or gas drillers want, then they go horizontally for a mile or two. And they insert this pipe, and they adhere that pipe to the rock wall of the well bore with cement. And this is where the problems come in. It is that cement and this casing that is failing. And studies coming from petroleum engineers show that you'll have 5 to as much as 10% of those casings failing within the first year. And then every year after that, the percentage of those casings failing increases gradually over time. So what we're looking at is the inevitable failure of these fracking wells, so that we're not just getting away from methane escaping. There will be a huge amount, almost every well being drilled now at some point in the future is going to fail, and those gases that are underneath are going to escape. So if we're talking about this 20-year time frame and then a 100-year time frame, no one has been factoring in right now this casing failure problem that guarantees we're going to have increasing levels of methane escaping over time so that we're not going to get away from it. Then you have the water contamination issue that is very serious, with thousands of wells being contaminated around the country, and the earthquake issue. And it's important that we understand what is happening too with the earthquakes. It's not just the property damage that we're experiencing in Kansas. We now know that millions of dollars of damage to homes, to public buildings, the courthouse in Harper County has $1.1 million in damage needed to repair from the earthquakes there. Hospitals where surgical equipment is toppling over in surgery rooms, and churches where steeples are cracked and in danger of collapsing on churches. The damages are really severe. But these earthquakes also serve to destabilize, again, these casings from these wells. So it's one problem caused by fracking exacerbating more potential greenhouse gas emissions. So we don't have a clear understanding within the public, and even in some cases within the scientific community, about these future greenhouse gas emissions. It's going to be far, far worse than people understand now because of the failure of the casings.
What do you say, though, to in parts of the country, I think Kentucky, Tennessee, and some of those areas, they have a lot of water contamination from coal ash?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm not suggesting that we don't have problems there. Duke Energy was just fined a huge amount of money for their coal ash spill in North Carolina and other companies, and we definitely need to stop the use of coal. I'm not an advocate for coal, but I do want to emphasize that we in the general population don't begin to understand the severity of this fugitive methane issue with fracking yet.
Yeah, to respond to that, one, this isn't a cable news channel, so this is going to be a very friendly debate. I'm not going to shout Joe down, and I don't see any sign that Joe is going to try to shout me down. I will completely acknowledge what Joe is saying about the problem with the toxification of millions of gallons of water per well of these fracked wells, and I'm also convinced that he's right that the at least in some parts of the country, different geologic formations, different parts of the country, but at least in some places, the injection of these fracking waste products is producing earthquakes. I mean, it's pretty obvious in areas where earthquakes were essentially unheard of. We're getting earthquakes all the time now, and what has started up in recent years? Fracking. I have not seen any definitive information or specific information about just how much of a problem the fugitive methane emissions from the wells themselves is compared to from the above ground transportation infrastructure for it, the pipelines, the valves, and all of that. I also know that it's not just an issue with fracked wells. That's an issue with natural gas wells of any type. Another factor that has to be taken account into this is that with any fossil fuel, you have associated other fossil fuels typically. So when you mine coal, you also get methane emissions because there's methane associated with coal. That's why we often, well, I don't know if I'd go quite so far as to say often, but occasionally get explosions in mines as buildup of the methane gases in there. So we're getting fugitive methane emissions from coal drilling or coal mining as well. We need to deal with all of this. I don't think we have a handle on just how big the problem is going to be from the cracking of the casings when these wells are abandoned, and over time how much methane is going to be leaking from the abandoned wells, whether fracked or conventionally drilled. That's got to be addressed. I don't think we have the research to say how much. One other point I wanted to make is when we're talking about the associated negative impacts of one fossil fuel or the other, we have to look at the associated impacts of coal as well. Much of the coal in the U.S. is still mined in Appalachia, which comes down to the way it's typically done now is you blow the top off of a mountain, you put your waste products into the valley, so you're clogging up the streams. They call it overburden in the industry. It's interesting the language they use to distance themselves from the actual impacts of what they're doing. So you have the mountaintop removal mining, and that has impacts. The explosions that they use occur when they blow the tops off of these mountains, and the people who live in the area who are already living in impoverished conditions. So there's associated impacts. I mean, I hope that what our listeners out there are hearing from what both Joe and I say, whether they think he is making the more persuasive case for coal or I'm making a more persuasive case for natural gas, is that they're both lousy choices, that we should not be we should not be spending a lot of time and energy trying to figure out whether or not we need to rely more on coal or more on natural gas for electricity generation, but that we should be going all in on efficiency first and clean energy infrastructure. That is the only real solution, because the problems with natural gas are only going to worsen, the problems with coal are only going to worsen, and of course we want to talk about plug-in vehicles, the problems with oil are only going to worsen as we go forward. So all of these things need to be addressed.
We do have a caller on the line. Okay, we're going to take a break first, and when we come back, we'll have a caller and we'll take the call.
This week, we explore the disappearing religions of the Middle East, from the Druze of Lebanon to the Zoroastrians of Iran.
The Middle East itself has flourished and prospered as a result of having these different minorities and religions in its midst. And it is an unhealthy and sad thing about the Middle East now that it is being deprived of the chance to have that coexistence.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
A new report suggests that eliminating racism in the criminal justice system is about much more than what's in a cop's mind. Hear from the report's author on Counterspin, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m.
Okay, we're back, and we're with John Kerman and Joe Speeson. We're talking about coal versus natural gas, and we have a caller on the line. Caller, would you state your first name and what area you're calling from?
This is Kurt from Prairie Village, and I wanted to say thank you for putting on the show. It's a great show. I would like for you to remind people more often that we should move away from both of these. We don't want this to look like CNN back and forth. I think the real thing is to move away from both of them. You're giving excellent reasons for doing that. The other thing I wanted to thank you for was not proposing nuclear as an option. I think that it would be, you know, definitely not an option. Good show. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay. One of the questions I had, we were talking about earthquakes, and my understanding, that is from the natural gas that is fracked. Okay. So
the oil. They have the same kind of wastewater problem from the fracking of oil wells.
All right.
Just different parts of the country where they're doing them.
At least in terms of natural gas, what percentage of natural gas comes from fracked versus other processes?
Right now, as I understand it, it's about half of what we're doing. And keep in mind that most of the fracking is being done in Kansas, for example, in Oklahoma, is for oil. Okay. But most of the production in the Northeast from the Marcellus formation is natural gas there. So it depends on which part of the country you're from. There's still a lot of natural gas being produced on a conventional basis in the Midwest. And that, as John has mentioned, isn't quite as bad as fracking in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, and just to put a little historical context in this, natural gas production in the U.S. peaked years ago and had been on a long decline, and it was expected it would continue to decline. And they were looking at building LNG import, liquefied natural gas import facilities here in the United States. And then with the rise in oil prices and natural gas is tied to that, prices for natural gas were going up as well, it became economical to start using fracturing. I mean, the techniques that they're using aren't really new. Hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling have been around for decades, but they were too expensive to use when oil was cheap, when natural gas was cheap. It only made sense to start using these technologies when oil went over $100 a barrel. It's profitable at below $100 a barrel, but it was that rise over $100 a barrel that really got companies interested in beginning to fracture. And natural gas prices were going up, too, because conventional natural gas production was declining in the United States. So that's the situation, and so this question of how much of the U.S. production of natural gas is currently coming from fracturing, I hadn't seen a number. I don't by any means question Joe's number, but what we can safely say is that percentage will increase because conventional natural gas production in the U.S. will continue to decline. That's not going to change. So the percent coming from natural gas will continue to rise until we wean ourselves off this stuff. And I want to make another point about that is the Energy Information Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy, has these really rosy projections of how much natural gas we're going to be able to produce in the future because of fracking, how much oil we're going to be able to produce in the future, and this whole notion that Saudi America and American energy independence and becoming the biggest energy exporter in the world, I think that's all a pipe dream. These fracked wells, they deplete much more quickly than conventionally drilled wells do, which means you have to drill new wells at an incredibly rapid pace. Outside independent observers are saying that the increases, that these Energy Information Administration projections for how much oil and natural gas are going to be produced going into the future are pie in the sky. And that's not hard to believe because the EIA typically has had rosy projections. Basically, they seem to put out projections that are what the energy industries, what the fossil fuel industries want us to believe is true.
Joe, before you respond, let me just give out the phone number. We will probably have time for one or two calls from callers. If you have any questions or comments, the number is 816-931-5534. Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I just want to expand on what John was saying here, and this is really important for people to understand. This, you can't believe what the energy industry and the EIA are saying in terms of the projections related to the amount of natural gas and oil that will be produced from these formations. The SEC is now pursuing litigation against oil and gas companies in California because they overpromised in their estimates of production from fracking in California by 96%.
The EIA, this Energy Information Administration, endorsed those projections. I mean, they basically buy the industry's line on everything.
And you can, there's a petroleum engineer by the name of Arthur Berman who's been making presentations around the country, and he explains what the oil and gas industry are doing in terms of their over-enthusiastic estimates, and he explains what is constitutes a deliverable amount of energy versus potential energy in these formations. And he explains why the oil and gas industry has been over-promising and under-delivering.
Okay, we do have another caller on the line. Caller, if you just state your first name and where you're calling from.
This is Jeff, and I'm over on the east side. Actually, I'm on the north side of Kansas City now. One of the things that I've heard you talked about a lot, especially in the fracking part of this discussion, is the millions of gallons of water that are being pumped down into the underground. And this is something that the aspect of removing all of that water from the air cycle, the water cycle, the rain going into the rivers and onto the ground and back up, you know, all of that being removed is not something that's been talked about at all. And I think that, you know, this is once again a case of we're not paying the price, the full price of what we're doing. We're making this water very, very toxic. We should be requiring them to clean the water and replace it from where they got it, because there's other people that need that water or other uses for that water, and it's just being taken completely out of the loop, so to say, when they start pumping this nasty stuff down into the ground.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. They're using, across the country, they're using hundreds of billions of gallons of water. In this process, they combine it with toxic chemicals and sand, and then when it goes underground in the fracking process, about half of that fluid comes back up. So you've already lost half of the fluid forever. But then when the fluid comes back up, more often than not, it's mixed with radioactivity and brine. And the problem is most of it can't be treated. They would lose money. The oil and gas industry would lose money if they attempted to clean that water. And that's why they then take that fluid that comes back to the surface and dispose of it in injection wells. And the caller is correct. That water is completely removed from the hydrologic cycle. It will never be part of our freshwater system again. And that is a gigantic mistake at a time when we're already seeing problems of severe droughts from climate change. It doesn't make sense to take hundreds of billions of gallons of fresh water out of the hydrologic cycle in the fracking process. In my mind, it's pretty insane.
Yeah, and particularly since a lot of the fracking is happening in areas that are rather arid to begin with, and we're using the already scarce water, millions of gallons. Now, we should acknowledge that the industry is working towards ways they can reclaim some of this wastewater and reuse it. That would be better, but that's not by any means a complete solution. I want to stress what Jeff said in his call up front, which is that this is another example of how we don't pay the true cost of our choices in energy. If we were paying the true costs of our coal production, of our natural gas production, of our oil production and combustion and all of that, they would not look cheap anymore when it compared to clean energy sources. And with the reductions in cost of clean energy, we are already getting close or past parity in cost without taking into account the associated pollution costs of these fossil fuel forms of energy.
We haven't touched on electric cars yet. Let's talk about that for a few minutes. Some environmentalists believe that we should not be encouraging electric cars in areas that are reliant on fossil fuels, that it's okay perhaps in areas like California where they're building solar energy at a faster rate and other areas where they're doing more with renewables. The concern is that in an area like Kansas is that if we have everybody driving electric cars too quickly, that what'll happen is we will increase the load to the point where they will justify building a new coal plant or a natural gas plant. Either way, so what is your take on that?
So the take on that is that it gets a little complicated. It's not so much whether your electricity grid has fossil fuels in it or not. It's what fossil fuels. The three different studies have looked at this issue. And if you look at the national average grid mix, electric cars are better than gasoline-powered cars or diesel-powered cars everywhere. But we don't really have a national grid. That's just an abstraction. What we have is regional grids. And whether or not a plug-in vehicle is a better choice than a conventional gasoline-powered vehicle or a diesel vehicle depends on your particular energy mix in your grid. So the Union of Concerned Scientists is the organization that has done the report on this that I find most helpful is a report called State of Charge that they've updated twice. And the most recent one, they concluded that 60% of the American population lives in areas where an electric vehicle with the average efficiency, because there's multiple models of electric vehicles now, the average efficiency of current electric vehicles, when charged from the 2010 grid, would be better than even the best hybrid as far as global warming emissions. Unfortunately, here in Kansas City, we are among the 40% in our grid. We are among the 40% of the American population that live in areas where the best hybrids are actually lower polluting than a plug-in car charged from our grid. And the way the Union of Concerned Scientists illustrates this is they have a map that shows for each grid what an electric vehicle with that average efficiency of the current models on the market would be, the emissions would be equivalent in a gasoline-powered car. In our area, their most recent figure is a 36-mile-per-gallon car. Now, that's better than most conventional gasoline-powered cars, but there are roughly 10 hybrid models that get better than 36, that get better than 40 miles per gallon or higher. So in our area, a 40 mile per gallon or higher hybrid has lower emissions than any of the electric vehicles that are currently available on the market. Now, they will get more efficient, but hybrids are getting more efficient too. Unless the grid moves towards clean sources of energy, as it should be, very quickly, that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future, unfortunately. I would love it. And for anybody out there who can afford to put up solar panels to charge their car, go for it. If you can afford the upfront cost of the car plus the solar panels to charge it, I think it's a great idea. But otherwise, buy a 40 mpg or higher hybrid.
Yeah, I'm really concerned about the push to move toward greater use of electric cars until there is a far higher percentage of renewables in the grid, renewable energy in the grid. So I still think there are better things to do. I've been a hydrogen advocate for a long time because it's, especially when you look at the coasts and the things that can be done, you can make hydrogen renewably using wind power at night and using salt water and wastewater. Plus, it stays in the hydrologic cycle anyway. I really am personally hoping for a stronger push for hydrogen vehicles. Yet there's been a great advance recently. Toyota has agreed to just give away all of their fuel cell patent information to anybody who would choose to develop really efficient fuel cells. There have been great advances. The problem with fuel cells is that the catalyst has been platinum, which is very, very expensive and scarce. But now they have come up with alternatives to platinum, including iron and cobalt, that are about 90% as efficient and effective as platinum as a catalyst, and obviously they cost about 1/600th as much. So I really believe that the potential for hydrogen fuel cells is going to be a much better solution than a transition to electric and battery cars until we have more renewable energy available in the grid.
I believe we are ready for our third break, and we'll be back shortly.
After I had sent President Johnson a telegram telling him to bring the people home from the Dominican Republic and Vietnam, and I said to President Johnson at that time, if this society of yours is a great society, God knows I would hate to live in a bad one.
The irrepressible Fannie Lou Hamer on the Pacifica Radio Archives from the Vault, Wednesday morning at 5.
One of my mentors was one of his bodyguards, a brother known in Harlem as Sunni Malik. And Sunni was like straight up, straight ahead, and would take you out on a dime. But he loved Malcolm, and he did his best with his comrades who were Sunni Muslims to protect Malcolm. But 2 weeks before Malcolm's death, Sunni and a few brothers were swept up off of the streets of New York, end up in a federal prison in Atlanta without any charges.
The assassination of Malcolm X on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Okay, we're back with John Kerman and Joe Spies. We have about 3.5 minutes left. So let me have each of you take about 1.5 to 2 minutes to just wrap up any final thoughts that you have.
Well, I think the most important thing we need to say about cars is we need to give up the idea that we're going to keep running more than 200 million automobiles, trucks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in this country on anything, hydrogen, batteries, anything. It's just not going to happen. We will not be able to afford to waste as much energy as it would take to keep doing that. It's just not going to happen. So we need to get off of that. Joe and I have debated hydrogen before. I'm not a fan of hydrogen for vehicles because we'd have to build a whole new hydrogen infrastructure around the country. And hydrogen is even harder to contain than natural gas is. So we have the issue with hydrogen leakage as well. But the main thing is we just need to get off of that. And I will just stress again, our main point is whatever we think about coal or natural gas for electricity generation, we need to be moving to clean energy.
Okay. And Joe?
Yeah, I agree. And my point with I'll make this real quickly before I get to my final point. You really don't need a massive hydrogen infrastructure. What you do is you make your hydrogen on site where you have a gas station now. You allow the electricity to power the electrolyzers travel. The electricity travels to the site, so you don't have to build this massive hydrogen pipeline system. All that is completely unnecessary. So we really wouldn't need to do that. And it's really a cost-saving thing. It would be a great boost for the economy because you have people manufacturing the fuel cells and the storage cylinders, and we can make the cylinders needed to contain the hydrogen very cost-effectively now using carbon fiber and other things. Now, the other point I want to emphasize is that we have to start promoting energy storage. For whatever we're doing for our energy uses, energy storage is going to be the key to allow for a greater development of wind and solar power that we have to have. Combining that with energy efficiency, energy storage is going to be the answer to all these problems, to allow us to get completely away from coal power or natural gas and allow us to have a much cleaner and cheaper future.
All right. I want to thank John Kerman and Joe Spies for being with us today. And we're going to turn it over to Natural Leaf in just a second for the calendar. For those of you who missed any of the show, we do podcast this, so you can always go back and listen to what you missed online at a later time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Craig and John and Joe. Our events this week are as follows. Confident City Cycling Class 1 on March 3rd at 6 p.m. in a three-class series taught by Bike Walk KC's LCI-trained instructors. Participants will learn new concepts for navigating streets and build practical handling skills necessary for city riding. The course culminates with an on-street ride to use new skills in a safe and supportive environment. Confident City Cycling satisfies the League of American Bicyclists prerequisite course for the League Cycling Instructor Seminar. It's a three-class series held March 3rd, 10th, and 17th. This class will be held at Bike Walk KC offices at 3269 Gillum Road, and this starts tomorrow. And you can find more information on their website, bikewalkkc.com. The Three Trails Recycling Center has reopened in their new location. The new address is 5630 East Bannister Road, Kansas City, Missouri, 64137. Their hours remain from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday. And finally, a fundraiser for wildlife. The Friends of Lakeside Nature Center are responsible for the care and rehabilitation of over 2,500 animals native to Missouri every year. This event is to raise money, collect food, and raise awareness for this wonderful facility and the animals in it. It takes place Sunday, March 15th from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. with free admission. They also offer live music, art, animal demonstrations, an ice cream sundae bar, and a scavenger hunt. Join them for an afternoon celebration of wildlife and music. It's fun for the whole family. You can also donate food like wild bird seed, dog, and cat food, wet or dry. Thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio, and we will be playing a clip from Waterworks.
Global warming forces an entire town to move, and other stories for the week ending March 1st.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The big news last week was that President Obama has promised, vetoed the Senate's approval of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline that, if built, would have moved tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to the U.S. Gulf Coast.
But the Keystone XL isn't the only contentious pipeline associated with the tar sands. Houston-based Kinder Morgan plans to expand its Trans Mountain pipeline that carries oil from Alberta to Burnaby, British Columbia, just east of Vancouver.
Kinder Morgan's proposal has sparked huge protests in Canada, and last Friday the company came under fire from the mayors of both Burnaby and Vancouver for failing to answer hundreds of inquiries about safety and groundwater monitoring.
The company had provided a heavily redacted version of a spill response plan, claiming disclosure of valves or critical access points would compromise the pipeline's security.
If the proposal is approved, it would increase oil tanker traffic from 60 ships to more than 400 per year, A report by Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans concluded that a rise in shipping would increase threats to endangered whale populations.
According to the Canadian conservation group Living Oceans, tanker traffic also threatens other marine life, including wild salmon, migratory birds, and shellfish.
The Canadian government has repeatedly promised a world-class marine safety and spill response plan as a precondition to the pipeline. But a recent Canadian government study found that, at present, Canada is totally unprepared to deal with oil spills of any kind off of its coasts or near its rivers.
The entire town of Kivalina, Alaska, is going to have to move. Why? Because according to the U.S. government, it may be too dangerous to live there. Usually the island is protected by ice, but global warming is changing that.
The town of about 400 sits on a fragile barrier island 80 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and the ice around the island is melting, which leaves it vulnerable to powerful waves that can wash across the town.
Kivalina is inhabited by indigenous peoples, and the ice around it used to be 8 to 10 feet thick. Now it's much more fragile.
But relocating the town will be costly, about $100 million, and who will pay for the move is an open question. The Obama administration has not said it will seek funding for the move, and according to a human rights organization, there is no government agency that has the responsibility to relocate an entire town. A new source of power generation is now being used in Portland, Oregon, and it comes from the water running in the city's pipelines.
Fast Company reports that Portland is using pipelines that have turbines in them to generate electricity as the water moves to homes and businesses.
Besides generating power, the turbines in the water mains provide information to system operators when water pressure drops due to leaks, which can then be found and repaired.
The Portland system is scheduled to begin full capacity power by March and is expected to generate enough electricity to power about 150 homes a year. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the state of Nebraska violated an agreement over the usage of water in the Republican River, and the court has ordered Nebraska to pay the state of Kansas more than $5 million.
Kansas sued Nebraska because it had disregarded a compact or agreement that controls how much water each state is entitled to use. It turns out Nebraska used way too much.
Justice Kagan wrote that Nebraska needed to be reminded of its legal obligations and that making Nebraska pay will deter future violations. And other people are surely paying attention because there are more than 25 compacts in the U.S. that allocate water among neighboring states.
But those in Nebraska are actually seeing the decision as a victory, because Kansas is getting only $5.5 million instead of the $80 million it had initially demanded. Also, the court declined to order Nebraska to shut down irrigation wells.
And finally today, turf wars. And we're not talking about street gangs or drug cartels. To the contrary, we're referring to the quaffed neighborhoods of Southern California, where pitched battles are growing between homeowners and homeowners' associations over grass. Yes, grass, but more precisely, fake grass.
Most homeowners' associations, or HOAs, prohibit the artificial material on front lawns, saying its out-of-place look damages community character. But the ongoing drought is causing many to question the wisdom of such rigid controls.
San Diego area Democratic Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez wants people to get real about being fake. She recently proposed a bill that would prohibit HOAs from fining residents for installing artificial lawns. In 2011, Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a similar measure, saying that HOAs, not the state, should make those rules.
Ms. Gonzalez says the public has the wrong image when it comes to artificial turf, saying it's not like the stuff you used to find on miniature golf courses. She claims that when she walks her precinct, she can't tell the difference between real grass and fake.
Despite the promise of saving money on water bills and the lack of maintenance, Southern Californians might still resist allowing synthetic turf, because in the land of facelifts, acrylic nails, and make-believe, The last thing you'd want is something artificial. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.